Well, hello, superstars, and welcome back to another episode of Word Up with Dani Katz. Today, I am so honored, so overjoyed to bring you another conversation with the one and only Stephen Jenkinson. Yay! Not only is Stephen Jenkinson one of my very favorite writers, thinkers, wisdom carriers, he's such a great podcast guest. And I was given the heads up ahead of time that I would only have Stephen for an hour. And I am very pleased that we were able to eke the conversation out past the boundaries of the 60-minute limits that I was given before we started. This was a phenomenal conversation about Stephen's brand new book, Matrimony, which will be hitting the shelves August 12th. And I don't know how much preamble there is necessary. I'm talking to Stephen Jenkinson. This is a podcast conversation with Stephen Jenkinson. I think that's pretty much all we need to know. And before we dive in, I am reminding you to click that subscribe button, to like, to share, to comment, to send this episode to at least 5 friends, because every conversation with Stephen is well worth as many ears as possible, and sharing is caring, and caring is wonderful. Also, reminding you to sign up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com. It's the very best way to ensure that we stay in touch, that you get to stay abreast of my every next offering, course, workshop, live event, book drop, product drop, all of those fun things. Also wanting to give a plug to my very favorite health, wellness, body care supplement tea line, Wildcraft Herbs. I did mention it a couple shows ago, and since then I've been blessed with my very own promo code, which gives you guys a discount when you place an order for any sort of body care, skin care, consciousness care, whatever it may be that you're inspired to nab at wildcraftherbs.com. I cannot recommend their products highly enough. Use promo code DANI11, that's DANI11, to nab your, I think it's 11% off discount. It might be more, it might be less. Don't hold me to it. It's a discount. Need we say more? All right, I think that does it for housekeeping. I do recommend grabbing yourself a nice beverage, getting yourself super comfy, cozy, because this is a phenomenal conversation with the one and only Stephen Jenkinson.
Dani Katz, there you are.
Lovely to see you again.
I'm glad.
How are you feeling these days?
Oh, God. You know, it's just this seesaw. It's a teeter-totter. It's just up and down. It's just like that.
Yep.
So most of the time, that's all right. How about yourself?
Feeling good. Strange days on planet Earth, but ever grateful for water coming out of the faucet and all of my limbs and digits and senses.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good priority.
Pretty much. Keeps us sane.
That's right. I'm just going to put on my glasses so I can see what all this jazz is around the outside of this frame.
It's a lot of exciting jazz.
Okay, I see now. Okay.
I wanted to acknowledge that I saw you when you were in Santa Fe. I loved the show. And I felt reticent to approach you after because I saw everyone wanting your attention, your recognition, and I didn't want to be another one of those people who wanted to take from you after you'd given so much on stage that night.
Okay. Well, that's very considerate, but you know, it is a package deal, and it's not that, it wasn't as in my memory that onerous, really. You know, it is a kind of strange consumer culture compliment, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, everyone wanted you to sign their books or say hello or have a meaningful word. And I get it. And I had just interviewed you maybe a week before, and I felt like it would be selfish for me to like take seconds, thirds, fourths.
Okay. Well, we're making up for it now.
Indeed, we are. So I am probably 3/4 of the way done with Matrimony. It's beautiful. Thank you so much for writing this.
Thank you.
I have a feeling that you could be assigned to write about cement and then unpack it in such a granular way that we're all astounded by what you're reflecting back to us.
Oh, shucks. You might be right, though.
Yeah, I think you might be just one of those writers who can write about anything because, I mean, yes, it was about matrimony, but it was about culture and social media and cell phones and everything. And matrimony seemed to be, you know, the scaffolding holding up all of your ideas.
I suppose it was. I think of it now, which is, it's very recent, right? It's very fresh. It's not even dry, you could say. But I think of it as a kind of a weather vane of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
They gave a very faithful rendering of the current weather patterns, you know, the rain, the wind, and so on. And I just employed its literacy, its cultural literacy, in the same way I employed death as a culturally literate proposition, and elderhood, and you know, money in the soul's design, and a few other things. So it's a kind of, I suppose you could say it's an old horse by now, in a way. Mm-hmm. But I have found it to be deeply a resonant and deserving of the attention that I gave those other ponies.
Agreed. And if it's okay with you, I made some notes on the book that we can go through a bit.
Sure.
So one of the first pieces that stood out to me was you wrote, coming to me to do your wedding is like coming to me to do your lung transplant.
Yeah.
Do you really believe that?
No. No, this was, it was a bit of an affectation by which I meant something in the order of this. In the early days, I'd never done it before.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never done a wedding. I'd never done the likes of it, such a thing. I'd never approached the proposition. Most everything that I've done was workable in terms of my sort of solitary stance, which over the years became the principal MO that I had.
Mm-hmm.
That I was a standalone proposition.
Mm-hmm.
And this I knew, not unlike being asked to name babies, which I've been asked to do.
Really?
Not unlike that, I did feel a sense of real moment that would not be comparable to, you know, every other endeavor, every other appearance and public appearance and so on. And then I felt that I had an enormous responsibility that being anything less than deeply and utterly prepared,
mm-hmm,
was a kind of travesty of sorts. You know, it was just add to the funeral pyre that I was in, that my senses were telling me were already the deal. So then I felt I had to sort of bone up, you know. I had to really knuckle down, study, but there's nothing to study. And so what I did instead was I studied why people came to me for this, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I studied their motivation, the language that they used to describe what they were hoping for and what they were trying to avoid,
mm-hmm,
ritualistically speaking. And so it's not altogether unfitting that I would say, I'm not a worthy consideration out of the gate. But if you were to ask me now, I feel a lot more capable to deliver the goods than I might have done at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that.
Having said that, I think I did deliver the goods, though.
At the weddings that you've officiated?
Yeah, I'm not saying that I felt ready necessarily, but I did feel summoned. And sometimes that'll have to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I feel I'd be remiss if I didn't admit that I'm one of the people you talk about who has no faith in weddings, who doesn't like going to weddings because I feel they're empty. There's a passage from your book that I'd like to read, if I may, and then we can unpack it.
Okay.
You say, and if you are among the clutch of witnesses I'm talking about here, it means that you waited out the invitation when you received it. You recognize it as the inadvertent summons that it was. You recognize it as a proper kind of jury duty. It means that you know that in these days, littered with sham rites of passage, glittering self-congratulation dressed up as ceremony and village-mindedness, ghosted by unlearned, unclaimed ancestry, and shabby personal truths, you'll have to do your best to stand in for all that's gone missing. And I feel heartbroken for how many times that I've taken that so meaningfully to be present for other people's exchanging of vows, only for them to throw those vows away and get divorced without so much as an apology or an acknowledgement. And I get frustrated taking other people's vows more seriously and sacredly than they are. And so I've stopped going to weddings because it breaks my heart.
I get that. I think you're describing some version of myself in the early days of when these requests started coming in. I mean, I certainly cast my memory over the tribulations that I'd been to before then, and only to discover that I came away, as I think the odd other person did, with the sense that this was a, the same sense I had about the pandemic, actually. There was this immense, if not monstrous, presence, but also opportunity. That we had a chance to see ourselves in a certain kind of light in action, and imagine remedies as a consequence of doing so. But to begin with a genuine three-dimensional, 360-degree take on what we bring to crisis, what we bring to the fray. And I think I agree with you, though you didn't use the word. I think the ritual life, such as it is in Anglo-North America, is a crisis. It's not in crisis. It's a crisis in and of itself. Now, bear in mind that a good etymology is really handy. And the word crisis is worth knowing about. It doesn't mean what we use it to mean typically today. The word crisis means something in the order of this. There are a number of contending possibilities. Inadvertently or otherwise, they have, for the moment, crossed paths. And it means that by virtue of them crossing paths, the moment for deciding is upon you, whether you see it that way or not. The moment of deciding is upon you. There will be other moments for deciding other things, of course, but the nature of crisis is, yes, it's generally speaking unsought, crises are, and unwelcome when they arrive. But if you do a little bit of sort of the existential math of the thing, you realize that a crisis does have the capacity to draw you nigh, to take you by the scruff, to be unrelenting in a way that the people who care for you most can't quite be. So it's quite remarkable in its facility, a crisis is. And I think that the emptiness that you've described so well is a kind of insult to the longing after a deeply better day that mobilizes, I don't know how many, what percent of the population, to be honest, but let's imagine that more people than not are feel summoned and challenged by the notion that it doesn't have to be like this. You know, we can talk about what you mean by like this, but for the moment, I'll just let it stand like that. Indeed, it's not part of the deal that it quote, is like this. But the visitation of how impoverished the circumstances are is a prerequisite, I think, for calling upon the best part of us to mobilize on behalf of this mythic better day. So as it happened for me, I welcomed the hardship of thinking on what was missing. Mm-hmm. And I found that what was missing had a certain kind of presence. It wasn't just a goneness. It was a abiding kind of echo of a sort. It was the best way I could describe it is I came to use the word shard, mm-hmm. which you may have come across, yeah? Mm-hmm. And what I was thinking was this. The ceremonies, such as they are, mm-hmm. that the dominant culture of these Americas make available to us, are they don't know themselves very well. Mm-hmm. They don't know from whence they come. They don't know what they're for. Mm-hmm. They don't know what reasonably should be expected of them, nor them of us. Mm-hmm. And they're broken. Mm-hmm. They're broken from disuse, from inactivity, from neglect, from misuse. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a bit of a list, but you get the general feel for that. And so along we come X number of generations or centuries or more later. And we come across certain detailia, you could say, mm-hmm. in the current regime. Let's take a couple of off-the-shelf goofy examples. There's this thing of throwing rice or confetti more recently. Mm-hmm. What is that? There's the business of walking up the aisle. Mm-hmm. Why is there an aisle? Mm-hmm. Why is everybody seating facing the same direction? Mm-hmm. Why are the principal players just a couple of people at the very front, not so much signaling ceremony as much as performance, right, or spectacle? Right. Why are there rehearsed lines? And no, even the discomfort is rehearsed. Mm-hmm. Even the offhandedness is a rehearsed thing.
Right.
Right. What's with the gifts? Why do they appear when they do? Mm-hmm. Why are they given to who they're given to, for example? So this just takes a few things. And all I did with each one of them is I didn't take them at face value. I took each one of them to be one of these shards that you find on the beach, you know? And if you have more than two, then with enough investigation, you go back and forth in an imaginative and devoted way. And eventually the three-dimensionality of this thing begins to suggest a kind of a shape, some kind of initial original shape or primordial shape or condition. Mm-hmm. And from the shape, you intuit something about the wholeness of the thing. Mm-hmm. And from the wholeness, you intuit something about the use or the purpose or the design or the material, something of this. So I'm thinking of it as a piece of broken pottery almost, aren't I? Something like this.
Yes.
From which if you're trained and you know what you're looking at, you can say an awful lot about where these people lived, where they obtained their clay, and why. Why did they inflect the rolling lip like this instead of like this, and 100 other things?
Yes.
I did the same thing with what's left of our matrimonial endeavor, and I found it to be remarkably truth-telling, mm-hmm. with enough attention and enough stillness that I made available to it. That's kind of how it started.
Mm-hmm. Now, I imagine that those who are seeking you out to officiate their weddings are people who have a connection to the sacred, who have a connection to lineage. It's not like any random person is going to come seek out Stephen Jenkinson to officiate their wedding. In my experience, because you and I are both custodians of language in our own ways, so I write books about the energetic frequencies encoded in words and how all those frequencies are programming us. So many, many years ago, when I was trying to figure out what are some lucrative applications of this work, I started to approach people who are getting married to write their vows with intention and to really like pave this life that they were together forging. And no one cared. They only cared about the dress or they cared about the flowers. And I once wrote a book about marriage that was not published. And I asked at least 100 people who got married why they made the choice to get married. And it was always, well, it was time, or I love her, but there was no clear, like, logical kind of journey as to why do I want to be in this institution called marriage at all. I didn't see anyone who was making that decision from a conscious place. They were just absorbing an assumption that they were going to get married, and it was just which, you know, person X was going to fill that place.
Or you could say it's kind of the next thing to do.
Yes, exactly.
It's a sense of inevitability about it.
Yes.
A sense of, maybe you could say, a kind of benign sense of obedience, rolling with the punches a little bit, appearing to be agreeable and not sort of intransient or overly dogmatic or things of, you know, all of these things are little signals, you know, that if you're willing to give here, maybe you can catch a break over here.
Yes.
Those kinds of things. But my experience of it probably a little different from what you've just described. Mm-hmm. But your preamble is absolutely on the money, that the people who came to me, they, I could put it to you this way. They had a number of adjectives they resorted to tell me what they were after when I asked them, why are you asking me to do this thing? Mm-hmm. And authentic and true and personal and meaningful. Those are the kind of words that tended to come up. Mm-hmm. As if all of these things are synonyms for good, mm-hmm. which they're not.
No.
But the most emphatic one that beat all the others by quite a margin was real. Mm-hmm. People were asking me to do something real. Now, here's the thing. They imagined two things when they used the word real. Three, I suppose. One, they imagined that we had a shared understanding of what that word meant and evoked and where it was headed and where we were headed because of it and so on. That's one. Two, they imagined that the shared understanding would result in a drastically positive, affirming outcome. Mm-hmm. And they imagined we could pull that off with a cast of characters that they were going to assemble around them that had little or no time in with this notion of real. Mm-hmm. You could somehow just set these people up. Do you know what I mean? In a kind of, like players on a chessboard or something of this kind, and that enough orchestration and, you know, good intention would rule the day. Mm-hmm. And I said to them, you understand the word real doesn't mean that at all. Mm-hmm. The word real means all in, head down, here it comes. That's what real means. I mean, last time I checked, the real thing as doesn't have the edges shaved off it.
No.
Right? So this is what, you know, what I pointed out to them and the way I tried to translate the challenge, because I knew it was a challenge, of course, mm-hmm. was to say to them that I was going to make a vow of my own as of now, as of this moment. And it was going to go like this. I was going to vow that I would be in matrimony's corner throughout. Mm-hmm. They looked at each other. They looked at me and sort of thought, okay, great. No. I'm going to say more because I know you don't know what I mean. Mm-hmm. You hear what I'm not saying? I'm not saying I'm going to be in your corner.
Right.
Or your corner. No, you got lots of people who are going to do that. You don't need another one. Mm-hmm. What you need here is somebody who's going to contend well with matrimony and be matrimony's amanuensis when the time comes. Mm-hmm. I will be matrimony's scribe, if you will. Mm-hmm. And what that means is from time to time, and possibly at crunch time, you, the betrothed, are going to probably decide that I've blinked on you, that I've gone the other way, that I've forgotten about you or about this moment or about how precious or important or real and all that stuff it is. And you're going to figure that I've abandoned you in some fashion. Okay. When that happens, and I pretty much promise that it will, I'm going to ask you to try to remember what I'm going to say to you right now. Somebody moved. You have to think again who it was. Who's moved out of the corner in question? It's fairly easy for me to stay in that corner. Once I've made this vow and I have some clarity about the purpose, the undertaking, I ain't going to blink. I've been around. I'm not going to keep the best of myself to myself. Not at all. I'm going to mobilize the thing as best as I understand what this means. You, on the other hand, are having a real experience now. And it's three-dimensional in a way you were hoping it wouldn't be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've had enormous problems with the invitation list. You've thought about bailing on the whole thing and going, you know, the destination beach situation or something of this kind. It's suddenly seeming like way too much trouble. Mm-hmm. Suddenly seeming like you have to explain yourself over and over and over again, and still the people don't understand why they have to come the day before, why the wedding lasts 8 or 9 hours. Mm-hmm. You know, what's up with where's the good old 15-minute wedding gone? And so on. So that's what I basically threw down between us as a kind of guidepost and gauntlet and go-between all at once. And, I mean, nobody said no. None of the couples said no. But, I mean, they and I discovered that, as you heard me write several times during the course of the book, it turns out that virtually nobody goes to a wedding to change the world. So that when you do, baby, you've got little or nothing in the way of genuine allies to undertake this work in real time with. And that can be fairly heartbreaking for people who have decided that the basic requirement here is that it's a special day. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it struck me in the book. It was very illuminating and a bit confronting as, you know, a post-second wave feminist woman who grew up in California. I feel like we've taken independence about as far as it could go. And I appreciate your reflections on the downsides of that, things that maybe I had thought were wonderful or things to be proud of, and realizing like, no, we've really lost something here. And how you're framing it in terms of matrimony, the ceremony itself being for the village, the tribe, the family, the community, to have the community there to hold the couple accountable to their vows when the times get tough. Is that accurate in terms of how you're seeing the value of matrimony in 2025, when we're no longer like, you know, creating peace between warring clans or whatnot?
Well, I'm not sure that that last thing is entirely true.
Okay.
I mean, people may be approaching each other with a view to making some kind of peace, whatever it might be, whatever the circumstance might be. It's possible nobody else knows the backstory but the families in question, for example. Okay. So let's grant that that probably is in the mix sometimes.
Okay.
Okay. But just as frequently, no, way more frequently, the two families, the two extended families, the two clans, they don't even know each other.
Right.
They don't know each other the day of. They don't even know each other a year later.
Right.
That's kind of the norm. Right. Okay. So, wow. So how can you conceivably orchestrate sort of, and the two shall become one sensibility. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll elaborate on that if you'd like me to in a moment, but the sensibility of that, how can you possibly, how is it possibly available when the place from which these two people come ancestrally, DNA-wise, everything else in between, remains fundamentally unknown one to the other? Mm-hmm. Where's the, I'm not going to use this in a very exacting and I hope positive and affirming sense of the term, where's the drama? Mm-hmm. Where's the ritual jam? Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Where, from whence does it come?
Right.
If there's no friction, if there's right. no engagement, if there's just everybody glad handing each other like this, there's no crisis. There's no interlock. It's just.
Right. It's not a triumph when they come together.
No. And it's
not, not friction beforehand.
And it's not a casualty if they don't, sadly. Right. Which I think you and I'd agree is probably one of the greater poverties that, that ensue. Nothing happens and everybody's relieved.
Right.
And it's on to the dinner and drinks.
Right.
Good God. I mean, if you just consider all of the stuff that's brought to bear upon this particular day, all of the lead up and the migraines and the friggin' expenses and all of it is for what? So, okay, so let's answer the question. Not euphemistically, for real. Mm-hmm. I'll try. So look at the invitation, which seems to be a niggling little detail, no big deal. Let's just look at it for a second.
But a lot what of trees.
A lot of trees. That's right. Even the treeless kind probably have trees somewhere in there.
Probably.
Let's ask about the wording. Mm-hmm. We're both word fans, so let's do it now. So one of the more typical things, if God and country don't appear in the invitation, which very frequently they don't.
Correct.
Then what's left? I think what you get typically is this. Join us. Curse, don't forget, cursive. I mean, nobody writes this way, but there it is. Join us for the celebration of love between so-and-so and so-and-so. Mm-hmm. Now, who, I ask you, could possibly be troubled by or let down by an invitation that includes an allegation that this will be a celebration of love? Me. What's my problem with it? Mm-hmm. It's this. It sounds, I mean, wouldn't it be something if there's more of it in the world? And the answer is, yeah, of course, it would be something. But this is not a way of getting there. If you claim that this love is already on, it's already so, then all you're turning this special day into is a kind of imprimatur, a kind of stamp of approval, a kind of allegation that the dearly beloveds and the assembled guests are, quote, witnessing to something.
And it's a bit showy, isn't it?
Well, just, like, yeah, of course it is. Yeah. But I think the real poverty is the allegation that it's already so.
Got it.
Okay. So what's your
done deal?
What's not going to happen is the whole thing being up for grabs, up for review, up for consideration. Let's see what happens kind of a thing.
There's no threshold to cross with that setup.
None at all. None at all. So picture this, if you will. There's dude at the front of the room in the vestments and so on, mm-hmm. or dudette, whatever it is. And then there's the two other dudes,
yep.
you know, sort of just missing their crowns, but otherwise clearly the hit of the evening.
Yep.
And imagine that they're being asked one at a time about what they're intending, what they're meaning with all of this, even think of the most standard, straight down the middle of the road vow situation. You still get a version of what I'm talking about now. Can you imagine this? Once the officiant finishes asking the question, the respondent says something like this: "Well, I've been thinking about this quite a long time. And it's very concerning. You know, the truth of the matter is, I've never done anything like what you're asking me if I'm going to do it. I've never done it. I've certainly never done it with this person right here. So wow, this is, it's a kind of, I'm out on a ledge here, am I not?" Right. That's one. Two, I mean well. Mm-hmm. I really do. But I mean, I don't have a track record, you know, 100 miles long on this matter to rely upon now. Mm-hmm. So how about if we just say for the moment, I've heard you and I'll try really hard and let's see what happens.
Right.
Nobody would stand for it.
No.
Especially not the guy who's paying the bills.
Right. But it would be more honest given how it rolls these days.
Maybe. Maybe. So what did I just describe? I just described the advent of a thing called promises.
Yes.
That's what promises are. Promises are stuff you say about what you're going to do.
Possibly, maybe.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm going to try.
Right.
So it's a bit of a pinky swear is really right. What it is.
Yeah.
It's a nod, nod, wink, wink. We understand. Like, we're not the old farts who used to get this so wrong and make all these exorbitant, extravagant declarations up here. We're just modifying everybody's expectation.
Yeah.
No. So that's what promises are. I mean, the word literally means to throw in before you or in front of. So promises are about the future. Mm-hmm. Promises require the future. The let's see what happens. The we'll see. The all of the good intention. All of that stuff. It's very interesting, though, that sometimes the standard down the middle of the road ceremony gets it absolutely right. And one of the places it gets right is the alternative to what I've just described to you, the alternative to promise. Because we don't use the word promise to describe what happens up there, do we? No. Nobody does. There's a word that we virtually never use in any other setting that I can think of with any frequency at all. In fact, I would say most people have never used this word to describe anything they've ever said or done. The word, of course, is vow. Mm-hmm. How is it different? Well, it's fundamentally different. And the clue, the breadcrumb trail through the forest, is the tense that the officiant will use to ask those very standard, very straight up questions. It begins with, do you? Mm-hmm. Not will you,
right?
Not should you, do you? Mm-hmm. That's present tense. In other words, the officiant is even in spite of themselves saying, okay, this is a kind of now or never moment. Mm-hmm. And there's a real consequence to what you say, to how you say it, to what you leave out and what you don't say. Mm-hmm. This is why we're rehearsing this Jesus out of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Make sure that there's no venue for chaos or the rest of the story to make its way in. Mm-hmm. So just tell me, do you? And instead of elaborating in response, you just get a yes or a no. Mm-hmm. I do. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay. So as I said, That's one of those shards, the I do moment. Mm-hmm. And the other one that's just prior to that, this used to be a legal requirement in many jurisdictions. It went something like this. You'll recognize it right away. If anybody here knows any reason why this should not proceed, speak now or forever hold your peace. Everybody knows that line.
Yes.
Right? Why was that asked back in the day? Well,
I assume because people were marrying their cousins.
There was a little bit of bigamy concern because record keeping was not that great back in the day.
Right.
For sure, that's part of it. But could there be more? I'm saying to you, absolutely there could be more. What would it be? Well, a flat out acknowledgement that there are reasons galore why this should not proceed. In fact, if you're real and realistic about it, you would say the reasons for not proceeding outweigh the reasons for proceeding, if you just put them on a scale. So what are you doing?
Can you break that down for a moment?
I think so. What the officiant is asking you to do is see whether or not you can break the spell of nothing's ever really going to change by what you declare now. Maybe you and the person standing beside you are the latest, greatest chance for this culture to get it right, right here, right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's the throwdown.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's at stake, near as I can tell. That's what could be. In order to get that sense in your craw at all, you have to have the other possibility, the possibility that this thing will go sideways so badly, not in 6 months or 2 years from now, right now, that we somehow, we just remembered now that we forgot to call in the saints and the ancients of days and the dusty worthies, the ancestors and the brokenhearted ones and the ones that never might quite made it here and the not yet quite born ones. And so like make a long list of the casualties. Okay.
Yes.
Make a long list of the people you frankly forgot about in crunch time.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that you don't turn to except when it would suit you to do so.
Right.
A lot of things, you know, are sort of boiling away on the stovetop of this event. I mean, the best word to describe matrimony would be drastic. And the word drastic actually comes to us from alchemy. It meant, it was an adjective that meant, it didn't mean serious.
Mm-hmm.
It meant the medicine in question, or the remedy in question, was three-dimensionally valent and consequential.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what drastic means.
Okay.
And from that point of view, I'm suggesting to you that matrimony is drastic indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Understanding that, again, there are the people who come to you to officiate their weddings, and then there's 99.99999% of the other brothers and sisters we're walking with in their authentic states of slumber, consciousness, confusion, whatever it may be. So from my perspective, it feels like our culture doesn't understand the value of a vow. It doesn't have the integrity or even the self-knowledge to be able to vow in a way that's honest. So how is marriage and matrimony relevant for the bulk of society given where we're at now?
Well, it's not relevant, but it's not a requirement. See, here's why. I mean, I'm old enough to remember a time when in my teenage years, we made all kinds of demands upon the curriculum in high school to be, quote, relevant to a 15 or 16 year old.
Okay.
Now, if we can be frank, do you know what it takes to be relevant to a 15 or 16 year old typically?
No, I don't.
Let's just call it, the stuff has to be topical, doesn't it?
Okay.
Has to have a certain buzz and then wears off and it's gone and next. And there's a bit of a, from a kind of phenomenological point of view, there's a bit of a attention span deficit situation ongoingly.
Right, you, there's a temporal immediacy.
Yeah, yeah. So in places where matrimony counts, one of the things they do is live their collective life in ways that can employ the matrimony that's undertaken, employ it, not feel complimented by it, not recognize themselves in it nearly as much as, okay, maybe a good way to describe it is this. I know you're quite aware of this, as are many people listening. In so-called traditional cultures, mm-hmm. then and now, there were ways of dressing and self-adornment that signaled from a great distance and from close up where in the arc of your life you were. Mm-hmm. There's ways of dressing that signal all these things. And there's an emphatic shift in the way people dress from before their wedding to subsequent to their wedding.
Okay.
Idea then would be, these are different people than they were.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this is where the origin of the word blessing comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when you seek out someone's blessing for your matrimony, you're not asking them to approve of it, no matter what you think, because that's not what the word means. The word blessing means to bloody. It means to bring to an end. It means to prosecute termination. That's what it means. Mm-hmm. But it, particularly the word blood, is the heavy association with bless.
Mm-hmm.
They're virtually the same word. So in cultures that understand and work this way, they would have understood and had agency in the following understanding.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose of matrimony is to put an end to the life that had been lived by these people and by their immediates as well, okay? Mm-hmm. To put an end to it, to employ the ending of it, to take the cue from the ending, mm-hmm. and to begin to orchestrate a collective engagement with what these people let themselves in for subsequent to the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
The fundamental shift in status and the expectation that would have come to them as a result of that, all of these things in times of yore would be quiet little givens.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You have nothing comparable now.
Mm-mm.
So what you have instead is a question that about the relevance that somehow suggests that the shoe is absolutely on the other foot.
Mm-hmm.
Every social, every cultural event has an obligation to pander to or to otherwise appeal to the people in question.
Mm-hmm.
But the notion that it should ever be the other way, that it's the people that have an obligation to the culture,
right,
is exceedingly rare proposition now. And even in kind of taken to be vaguely insulting and clearly not hip.
Right.
So, I mean, I find that very lamentable, because there were times when people understood absolutely that the best of us is not for us. The best of us as humans is that the world benefits as a consequence of that best appearing with some frequency. Called upon, mm-hmm. and appearing and spent with some frequency and mm-hmm. some agility and some style and some capacity as well. Mm-hmm. So tuition is a big part of the understanding here, that these things have to be learned over time. And if you grew up in a culture that was practicing all the stuff that we're talking about, nobody would be talking about it like I'm talking with you now. There'd be no need to, because these things are available as a matter of course, in the same fashion. It's marrying and burying in exactly the same fashion that the way people die would not be the stuff of seminars and teaching events and books and the rest. These things would be an understood example of what cultured people do in crunch time. Not just a dying person, but all the people around them.
It's interesting, because I'm thinking of so many of the topics that you cover in the book, and how it, perhaps it is the case that it's only when something's broken that we really examine it and recognize the value and unpack it the way you have, right? Like if our culture was thriving, if matrimony was thriving, if our partnerships were thriving, then maybe you wouldn't have so many ideas about it, because there you wouldn't be called to come in and break it down the way you have. In the book.
I'm not sure we're at that level of insight on the matter. My experience, especially the confrontational, aggressive reactivity that came our way when we tried to do it differently, that suggests to me that there's not a degree of frank weighing out of the various expectations we might have of such a thing. I see very little in the way of persuasive evidence that the dominant culture that I'm a product of is fundamentally interested in its impoverishment.
Oh no. I think it's those of us who are out on the edges with more of a macro perspective who like to, do these sort of granular deep dives and unpackings. We can see it, but I don't know that culture itself is ready to take on that perspective about itself.
If that's true, and I'd have a hard time making a lot of a case against what you just said. Mm-hmm. If that's true, then those people on the fringes that you're describing, they're failing in some fundamental way. And part of their fringeness mm-hmm. might be part of their failing. Here's mm-hmm. what I mean by this. Mm-hmm. It seems to me, I'm going to talk about artists for a moment. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that the fundamental responsibility, the moral code that adheres to a practicing or a working artist mm-hmm. might be this. It may have been true in the past, but it's definitely not true now, that the artist's principal obligation is to reflect the culture back to itself. Mm-hmm. I don't think reflection of that order is effective, consequential. I think it lends itself to the cult of personality that wraps itself around artistic types, for example, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm suggesting to you now that I think the artist's responsibility is refractive, not reflective, by which I mean the skillfulness that's lent to you by the accident of your birth, by whatever proclivities you're born to, by whatever family stuff, prevailed, and all of that, mm-hmm. all of it has the obligation, it seems to me, to, with as a consequence of real learning on this matter, mm-hmm. that the invisible acculturation that prevails in the time and in the place that we're both referring to now.
That does it for the first chunk of my conversation with Stephen Jenkinson. As you are inspired, as I know you are, to tune in to the second part of our conversation, you can find that on both my Locals and Patreon communities. Those addresses are dannycats.locals.com and patreon.com/dannycats. At both of my membership communities, for as little as $5 a month, you get access to all of my second half conversations, plus oodles of bonus content. Choose whichever platform feels most aligned for you, if not both, and do join us there for the rest of this awesome conversation. Before I sign off today, one last reminder to click that subscribe button, like, share, comment, send it to all your nearest and dearest. Sign up for my newsletter at dannycats.com, and also to use promo code Danny11 at Wildcraft Herbs, because all of their stuff, they grow it themselves, they make it themselves. It's a small business that packages everything themselves. They pay their farmers a living wage. Like, for those of us who are tuned to voting with our dollars as far as how businesses are doing businesses, how the resources of our planet are honored, this place is, it's a business that you can feel, I would say, proud to support across the board, like on every level, they're making great products. They're doing it in ways that are honorable and respectable and respectful of everyone with whom they're working. So do head on over to wildcraftherbs.com. Do fill up your cart. Do use promo code Danny11 when checking out. And then join me over on the Patreon and the locals for this stellar conversation with Stephen Jenkinson. Thank you so much for sharing your sacred attention with me. Thank you for remembering that every word matters, that you are omniscopic amazingness. I will see you over on the aforementioned locals and Patreons. Have a rockin' day.